Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Another one scheduled to win, Derek Anderson. Good. You're going to do great. We're going to get it. He's running against one of the Vindman twins. Vindman, is that correct? The Vindman twins, these are the worst people. You got to win that race, Derek. They are the worst people. They reported a false conversation. They made up a story about a certain conversation that was false. And they act like they're hot stuff. They're not. All they have to do is look in the mirror and they'll realize. And look at this guy. He's like a movie star, right? Look at this guy. No, the brothers, they're twins. And I heard one is worse than the other. I think you're running against the worst one. We're going to fight for you. You got to win that race. You got to teach the Vindmans. We got to get them out.
That was President Trump campaigning in Virginia last June and still obsessing about the Vindmans, Alexander and Eugene, twin brothers who immigrated to the United States from Ukraine when they were 3 years old and grew up to serve their country. Alexander, as an Army officer who earned the Bronze Star fighting in Iraq and later as Director of European Affairs at the White House National Security Council during Donald Trump's first term. Eugene, meanwhile, also served as an Army officer before becoming deputy legal advisor in the same NSC where Alexander worked. He's now a Democratic congressman from Virginia. It's not hard to figure out why Trump had it in for the Vindmans. Alexander Vindman was one of several White House officials listening in on Trump's notorious 2019 phone call with Vladimir Zelensky, in which the American president pressed the Ukrainian president to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Vindman was disturbed by the call and reported it up the chain to his brother, among others, thereby triggering the events that led to Trump's first impeachment. While Eugene went on to be elected to Congress and just got a threatening letter from Trump's U.S. attorney in Washington, Alexander Vindman has written a new book, The Folly of Realism: How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. In it, he takes a step back to help explain the historical roots of the Russia-Ukraine conflict and puts Trump's efforts to pressure Zelensky, during his first term, to give him political dirt, during his second term, to sign a peace deal with Putin, in historical context. He joins me now on Spy Talk. Alexander Vindman, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Congrats on the new book, The Folly of Realism. I want to talk about it quite a bit, and there's a lot of really fascinating stuff in there. But look, I've got to start out with two items very much in the news as we speak. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Thursday he's not necessarily opposed to the ceasefire deal the U.S. and Ukraine has worked out to stop the war, but he has some reservations and conditions, and there are nuances he wants to discuss directly with President Trump. What's going on here? Is Putin going to go yeah. along with a ceasefire, or is this dragging it out for some further purpose?
I think this is more of the quintessential cat and mouse. In this regard, it's more like the cat toying with the mouse. It is,
and in this case, the cat is Putin, and the mouse is who? Is the U.S. Trump. Or UK? Is Trump?
It's Trump. And you know, I look at this from a technical standpoint as well as kind of a strategic standpoint. So, from a technical standpoint, you have the leader of Russia in office for 25 years. His negotiating team, top negotiators, have been with him basically since the beginning. Lavrov is the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Ushakov as his foreign policy advisor, a previous ambassador to the U.S. And these guys are head and shoulders over the U.S. side of the negotiating team. I mean, we're talking about like the most competent folks, and they are, you know, would be considered competent. Senator Rubio, Mike Waltz as a national security advisor, former congressman, you know, National Guard, Green Beret. So some experience, you know, some diplomatic experience, but they're really on, it is unbalanced in such a huge way against these folks that have negotiated against multiple different administrations, professional negotiators on the U.S. side, statesmen, diplomats that are steeped in how the Russians operate. So it's a mismatch there. What we're seeing unfold is really Putin understanding that the last person to talk to Trump gets their way. And just in the course of this last exchange, where initially Ushakov said they're not going to take the deal, it doesn't make sense for them. And then Putin coming across as the reasonable actor, saying, you know what, we might be able to work with this, but, and it's a big but in this case, it's a lot of conditions that are really, frankly, in a lot of ways, intended to be poison pills to drag out the conversation, but to not kill the chance of dangling in front of Trump the potential to normalize relationships and end the war. But it's exactly, you know, the opposite of how you would want to conduct negotiations with Russians from a position of strength with leverage. So it's not going to amount to anything. The Russians think they have the upper hand. They think that they are favored in a long attritional war. They see pressure building on Ukraine. They see fissures developing between the U.S. and NATO. They see the potential for Trump to be enticed to further ease and normalize and embrace Russia. And there's, you know, from their standpoint, there's not that much to do. But they're also mindful of the fact that, you know, they don't want to needlessly create a blowback situation. So they're handling it in a fairly sophisticated manner.
So, but I mean, at the end of the day, though, I mean, is Putin going to go along, or does this ceasefire deal just collapse and the war continues?
Yeah, I don't see how it could possibly go along. It goes against, you know, everything that my research in my book suggests about how you deal with Russia. You know, the Russians put bright, shiny objects in front of you about like normalization, ending the war, at the same time keying in on fears. And this is what they're doing here with Trump. I think that this is not going to yield much in the way of results. Already, Trump has bitten off on what Putin said, that like this whole Kursk thing where the Ukrainians have a pocket inside Russia has to be somehow separately resolved. And you know, it's framed as the Ukrainians being completely surrounded, besieged, thousands are gonna die. This is the way he painted the picture for Trump. Trump has embraced it. So now he's going to say, well, like, you know, to the Ukrainians, we need to go ahead and figure this out. You could withdraw your troops or something of that nature. That's a precursor to even doing this 30-day ceasefire. In a lot of ways, it's meant to be a poison pill, but to shift the burden back on the Ukrainians or something of that nature, because Trump is getting played.
So you do not think there is going to be a ceasefire?
I don't see how this results in a ceasefire, no.
And the war just drags on.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean,
look, you have wanted all along for, and we'll get into this from the book, a much more forceful response to the Russians, much more military equipment being provided to the Ukrainians to allow them to take the fight to Russia. A ceasefire obviously goes in a very different direction. Are you saying you would prefer continued military conflict at this point to a stop in the fighting and killing?
That's not at all the case. I think the fact is that, you know, nobody wants a ceasefire and peace more than Ukrainians. They just want to make sure that it's an enduring peace and not one that allows Russia to lick its wounds and come back and snap up more territory. I'd love to be wrong on this one. I just, in this particular area, in my area of expertise, I'm rarely wrong. I'd like to eat my words here, but I don't see how this results in a ceasefire. I think if anything, it kicks the can down the road further. I thought maybe there's a chance that Putin would bend over backwards to be accommodating here, just to just to normalize relationships with Russia. He's not even doing that. He's going back to the kind of same playbook of adding in different conditions, making it hard, creating conditions for further negotiations. It just further substantiates that. I don't see how this gets us to where we want to get to.
All right. The second item in the news, which I need to ask you about, is the Washington Post reported the other day that your brother, Eugene Vindman, the congressman from Virginia, just got a letter from Ed Martin, the interim U.S. attorney in the district, Trump's choice for that position, telling him to provide information about a company you and he set up to provide American weapons to Ukraine. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is just this is a particularly kind of colorful character, a henchman kind of type figure that's looking to harass. He's not just went and inquired about Eugene and his work with regards to, one of the lines of inquiry was his work as a contractor for the Department of State. Conducting 14 trips to Ukraine to investigate Russian war crimes. So this guy wants information on that. He's actually harassed. He's also, on social media harassed me, saying that I'm the reason that Zelensky didn't take the rare earth deal. This is just a guy that's looking to come up, kind of muck around. I think he sent out a dozen of these types of notes. With regards to my activities in Ukraine, I do a massive amount of philanthropy. I probably raised about $20 million just trying to, leverage my name to channel resources to Ukraine for humanitarian purposes, to help the Ukrainians on the battlefield, things of that nature. And I try to do the same thing in the private space, connecting U.S. defense tech with Russian defense tech. That's all pretty much kind of evaporated under the Trump administration, but I'm not giving up on my philanthropic work. We're continuing to do humanitarian, medical type gear and stuff like that to the armed forces.
Have you gotten a letter as well from the U.S. attorney?
Not that I'm aware of, but I also probably don't make myself super easily accessible.
Right. But I mean, look, my understanding is he referenced Martin, the U.S. attorney, referenced this company Trident Support, in which you're the chief executive, and I guess your brother is the chairman. What is the company, and what does he seem to be looking for?
I mean, this is a part of the extreme right-wing narrative that somehow political opponents of Trump are involved in some sort of, war-related profiteering in Ukraine, which is, frankly, an interesting kind of, again, another element of tradecraft where you counter accuse on the corrupt schemes that you're engaging in yourself as a distraction. It doesn't even warrant any further investigation or frankly, explanation on my part. People could investigate whatever they want because there's nothing to hide.
But what is the company Trident Support? Is that still an active matter? And what does it do?
Trident Support is not an active matter. Like I said, after Election Day, I've wound down. I think there's I don't have any active clients. I'm basically trying to connect U.S. defense tech with Ukraine in ways that couldn't work in the philanthropic scheme. So I thought about different ways to be able to plug U.S. Defense tech that could help the Ukrainian war effort, including potentially logistics support for all the Western gear that we were providing without any means to sustain it, which is one of the reasons where this whole idea kind of originated. But I don't know.
Well, I loved this detail from the stories about this, because you referenced the multiple letters Ed Martin, the U.S. attorney, the interim U.S. attorney, has sent to various players on Capitol Hill and others who are perceived as enemies of the president. And I think this is from the Washington Post story. The letters are styled as voluntary, quote, letters of inquiry, not compulsory legal demands, and often bear signs of haste, such as wrong addresses, typographic errors, or in the Eugene Vindman's case, a failure to state a deadline for a reply, writing instead only, quote, please respond by day, comma, month, comma, date, comma, 2025.
You know, I guess, like, I it's so much just random noise that it's like we could be talking about a lot of other important things. I mean, everything I do is extremely transparent. So I feel like it's a waste of time to talk about these things. But sometimes I guess you're right. You probably do need to, you know, at least give some sort of quick response on it.
Sure. I totally take your point. But he is the interim U.S. attorney. He does have prosecutorial powers. And we do need to take note when he takes actions of this kind. But let's talk about your book. Your subtitle, the book is called The Folly of Realism. The subtitle, How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, so you don't have to look very deep. I mean, the subtitle couldn't be more perfect, frankly, for the moment, except for the fact that I would change the tense. I would have changed it to how the West deceives itself about Russia and betrays Ukraine. Maybe just the present tense as opposed to the past tense. It's the fact that we have undertaken what has been colloquially called resets with Russia multiple times throughout six different administrations, catering to hopes and fears, hopes that we could get the Russians on board. You know, Trump administration wants to do some sort of economic deal. Previous administrations have worked hard on arms control. Others have looked at climate change. Others have looked at cooperation on rooting out transnational terror groups, like bright, shiny objects that really very, very rarely materialized. Or fears, because the Russians have been quite effective at getting us to recoil in shock at the nuclear saber rattling. It was effective in staying President Obama, for instance, in his response to 2014 when this war started. It's been going on for 10 years. It was effective in getting the Biden administration to focus in on de-escalation. It is effective repeatedly with Trump. Multiple times where the Russians were signaling that, you know, this could lead to a spiral in increasingly unfriendly relationships. I remember vividly from my time in the White House an episode in which the Russians attacked Ukrainian Navy peacefully transiting the Black Sea, the Kerch Strait, and Trump recoiled in fear, in terror in that episode, and ceased all U.S. Military operations, including treaty-based open skies activities and stuff like that. So they're quite effective at using this tool.
Can you explain what that incident was? Because I'm not sure what you're
referring
to. That
was November 2018. The Ukrainians were moving some small boats from Odessa into the Sea of Azov to Mariupol. And the first time they transited, no issues. The second time, the Russians attacked. And it was a small flashpoint, and the president, his immediate knee-jerk reaction to was to cease U.S. operations. I thought it was out of misunderstanding. I thought it could have been that he didn't understand the facts as the Russians were attacking the Ukrainians, conducting a freedom of navigation or something of that nature. But I think it could have been easily fear or the fact that he just didn't want it to blow his relationship with Putin. So, but this is just one, you know, specific example. It goes across multiple different administrations, all the way from George H.W. Bush. That's the deception, how we deceive ourselves about Russia. And betraying Ukraine is basically as an afterthought. I think what you saw in the Oval Office between Trump and Vance attacking Zelensky was a display of maximum malice and maximum ignorance. The maximum malice is that they could care less about Ukraine. They want to normalize relationships with Russia. And that they, you know, on that basis, Ukraine is irrelevant. They'll do as much as they could get away with. And ignorance is the deception. that we've done this multiple times.
You know, throughout the book, you do downplay the concerns in Washington about a nuclear standoff with the Russians. And you talk about how Jake Sullivan had, I think you use the phrase, excessive concern about Russian nuclear, the use of nuclear weapons by the Russians. But look, for those of us who grew up during the Cold War, the threat of full-scale nuclear warfare was, you know, perhaps the most existential threat we faced. And I mean, isn't it reasonable when you're talking about dealing with another country that does have an arsenal of powerful nuclear weapons to put that first and foremost in your concerns when you're dealing with that country?
It is not if your actions actually drive the situation to become more acute. It is quite unreasonable to repeat the same mistakes of the past. I would say that if you're driving a situation in which you're being a victim of nuclear extortion repeatedly, and you're driving a nuclear proliferation around the world where you have more nuclear powers, including amongst our allies, more is more dangerous. More is more complex. If you're driving that kind of situation, then you're not doing something that's in the U.S. national security interest. The problem that I see with a lot of the discourse around this topic is that we have this knee-jerk reaction, and the Russians know it really well. They exploit it through a doctrine they call reflexive control. It's a doctrine that makes us focus on the consequence, which is catastrophic, which we should take seriously, but negate the probability component. And the probability component is basically near a zero. Why? Because of mutually assured destruction. We want to be careful on how we manage this. We want to make sure that the Russians know that we're ready, that all our adversaries know that we're ready. And we don't want to stumble by accident or miscalculation into this kind of a spiral or confrontation. But the Russians are not suicidal. The Russians are not interested in a confrontation. Another short story on why I could speak about these things comfortably is one of the most dangerous episodes in my tenure in the Pentagon was when U.S. cruise missiles were flying into Syrian bases occupied by Russians in response to Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons use against the civilian population. And this was under the Trump administration. And the saber-rattling that was coming out of the military, out of the Russian general staff, was like, we will defend ourselves, make sure that you're strictly avoid, targeting these bases. And the response from our side was, we are going to prosecute these targets. This is the course of action that the president's chosen. Take shelter. Make sure you've been warned. Do not attempt to respond in kind. And you could see the way that the Russian general staff leadership basically took that warning very, very seriously and did not look to tangle with the U.S. The Ukraine, what we should understand about this war between Russia and Ukraine is Russia is having a hard time fighting Ukraine. It is not interested in any immediate confrontation with NATO, let alone the U.S. They are not interested in a conventional spiral or a nuclear spiral. What we should be doing is we should be following the lessons that our predecessors, whether that's Reagan, Carter, Nixon, Johnson, Kennedy, Eisenhower, all these folks had a lot of experience with regards to a nuclear Soviet Union. And they, of course, were looking to carefully avoid any confrontation with Russia, but they also understood the consequences of succumbing to hopes and fears in particular, nuclear extortion, that they stood their ground. And we lost some of that understanding of who our adversary. It's mainly because we just don't understand our adversaries the way we used to in the past. And that's the basis on which I criticize the Trump and all the administrations.
Yeah, you criticize every administration since the fall.
I've got
of
a
the
lot
Soviet
of evidence
Union.
To. I've got a yeah. lot of evidence to substantiate. If you read about this historic pattern of George H.W. Bush coming in and saying, "Ukraine, simmer down. You don't need your independence," and how the Ukrainians responded to that, or the Clinton administration coming in and being hyper-focused on this non-proliferation issue to the detriment of their desires to get the Ukrainians to denuclearize, to the Orange Revolution, where basically we chose to not be either particularly critical of Russia or support Ukraine when they had a pro-Western president, or 2008 with the Georgia War, or 2014 when this war started. There is a overwhelming amount of data that we should have learned lessons of the past. And if we could be forgiving maybe in the early days in the 90s, it is hard to be forgiving in the 2000s and 2010s when we keep repeating the same mistakes of the past and make the situation far more acute and dangerous for ourselves.
Can I just, you know, when you were talking before, you mentioned that the Russians are not interested in a confrontation with the West, with NATO. And if that's the case, doesn't that undercut one of the principal arguments for supporting Ukraine in this war, which is that if we don't stop the Russians here, they're going to go on to Moldova, they're going to go on to the Baltics, they're going to go on to Poland. If they're not looking for a confrontation, as you just said, maybe that fear, concern, that argument is not as strong as people have suggested.
That's actually not what I said. I said in the short term. So I think there's a different time horizon here. But if you take the opening quote of my book,
yeah,
I talk about something, a very famous line and very astute line from Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor for Carter, which talks about Russian power, historical Russian power, that Russia absent Ukraine really fundamentally is irrelevant. But with Ukraine suborned and subordinated, folding Ukraine in makes Russia a much, much more powerful threat. And of course, the Eastern Europeans know this better than anybody else. They were under the yoke of the Soviet bloc, under Soviet power. So the Poles, the Balts, the Romanians, they all understand this. And I think the fact is this is an empire-building project inside Russia. For Russia, it's central to have Great Russia, which is the Russian Federation, Little Russia is which what they refer to Ukraine as, and Belarus. And as that core, then they could have bigger aspirations. And the estimates are that, you know, immediately there's no threat. But if you have this whole thing is about Russian empire and Russian identity. So if you have Ukraine folded in, then you have something much, much more potent to contend with. 40 more million more people, a serious battle-hardened military down the road, as well as a Russia that recapitalized its military. That is a huge threat. That's on the interest side. But there's also a values component. For 80 years after World War II, the U.S. has underwritten a world order, and this is important because it's about values and interests. We've underwritten a world order that specifically, explicitly talks about the fact that great powers don't engage in military war, wars of aggression, empire building against their neighbors. That led to a long period of, you know, Cold War, but also stability and prosperity for the U.S. We can't give up on the values or the interest side of this equation. Ukraine is about servicing both of those. It is in U.S. clear U.S. national security interests from a values and interest perspective to support Ukraine for all these reasons I just laid out.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Alexander Vindman about his take on the curious relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And we're back. Let's talk about Donald Trump, somebody with whom you are inextricably interwoven with in historical context. Look, there's been an ongoing debate for years among journalists, scholars, others about Trump's affinity for Putin. Is this merely a case of autocrat envy? Putin rules Russia the way Trump would like to run America? Or is it something darker, that he has somehow been manipulated or even controlled by Putin and the FSB? Where do you come down?
You know, I come down on the I don't come down on, spy talk side, which is conspiracy side.
No, well, I hope you're not suggesting that spy talk itself is conspiratorial.
I'm saying that's when not spy talk the show, but that you know,
okay,
the reference. So because the fact is that you in government, you kind of, you know, you see that the government leaks like a sieve, and keeping these things, you know, deep, dark secrets, it just doesn't really work out. So I would say this. I would say that if you were to take a step back, you put this in a kind of a cinematic frame, this you'd almost see like a Manchurian candidate style administration, a 180 degree reversal of everything that the U.S. has been engaged in thus far. Friends become adversaries, adversaries become friends. I think Putin couldn't have wished for somebody better than Trump to deliver, you know, what he needs. So it does really, like, it begs the question, why? Because what's in it for Trump? Yes, he feeds his ego of, you know, making friends with these autocrats, but he also is a guy that likes wins, and he's not getting any wins. He's not getting his, you know, his Nobel Peace Prize. So that's troubling. I'd say there is some pathology here. The pathology is up is down, down is up. You're telling me that, you know, Russia's bad. I'm telling you it's good. You're going to see things my way. I think it is this proclivity for autocrats. It is also a deep vindictiveness against Ukraine. I think it's all of these things that, you know, come together to shape the policy that we have towards Russia, towards Ukraine. What's frankly more inexplicable is how we treat our closest allies, except if you put in this frame from the book, The Folly of Realism is about the fact that we're highly transactional. That was the fundamental folly, that everything was like immediately what was in front of us. We were catering to these hopes and needs. He's highly transactional. On that basis, he completely doesn't understand why having good relationships with Europe and NATO and Canada are more important than, you know, squeezing out like a couple extra cents here and there. That's the folly of this guy, Trump, and what he's and the mistakes he's committing here.
But you do not give credence to the idea that the Russians somehow got something on him, are holding it over him, and are manipulating him. And
high bar.
I'm sorry?
That's a high bar for me. I haven't seen anything that's conclusive. Was there collusion? I mean, you know, you could describe it however you want, but there was a high degree of effort from the Trump administration, a Trump campaign in 2015 yeah. going into the 16 elections to get the Russians to tip the scales. That was behind the scenes. Later on, it was actually completely overt, right? Later on, he actually said, "Hey, Russia, hey, China, give me those emails. I want to see all that." So it wasn't like he was keeping secrets after a while. Right. That kind of stuff, yes. But in terms of like a PP tape or something like that.
Yeah. This guy, the KGB guy in Kazakhstan, who put on Facebook the other day that they had recruited Trump back in 1987 during a trip to Moscow.
I've heard that too. Actually, more interesting is what Nikolai Petrushev, the former director of the FSB, old KGB officer, then the head of the National Security Council. I've met him probably a handful of times. His comment was that Trump is obligated to serve the Russian interests because the Russians did him a favor in helping him get elected. That's him just being a typical kind of propagandist, a mischief maker to sow discord. But he said that if anything, has got more credence and credibility than anything else.
Yeah. Look, you obviously came to public attention back in 2019. When you testified before the House about the notorious phone call between Trump and Zelensky, and you were disturbed by it, you reported it. It ultimately did lead to Trump's first impeachment. Now, that was, 2019? Here we are, you know, 6 years later, and Trump is president once again. As you look back on that whole exercise and whole series of events that led to Trump's first impeachment, which obviously did not block him from returning to office, how do you process it today? I mean, was it a mistake to impeach Trump? Was it a mistake to impeach him in the way they did it and for the things that he did? Or, you know, was it the right thing to do regardless of the lack of consequences that have flowed from that?
So the issue for me was pretty straightforward. I saw corruption and I reported it. I think the fact is that, you know, obviously this was resolved in the political sphere with Republicans failing to hold and therefore emboldening Donald Trump to engage in activities that resulted in a second impeachment and all the damage he's causing today. I think, you know, if anything, what brings me some pain is understanding that, like, somehow me being loyal to the Constitution focused the lens on other career public servants to be treated, you know, then targeted for loyalty tests. That is something that doesn't sit well with me. But in terms of holding the line, supporting rule of law, I think that, you know, that's all our obligations. We swore an oath to do that, and you know, that's not something I reflect on.
So no regrets at all on the first impeachment.
I'm happy. I'm glad he was impeached. What do you want me to say? I mean, seriously.
No, I'm just, you know, look, he was impeached, but in some ways it emboldened him and his MAGA allies and made them even more vengeful.
It was the failure of the Republican Party to hold him accountable.
Right.
That emboldened him, not the impeachment itself, which was on the merits.
As I mentioned before, Trump is hardly the only president who you are quite critical of. Barack Obama, with his reset for Russia, which you argue was a huge mistake, and also the fact that he did not respond vigorously to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. I want to talk about that a little bit, but also I didn't realize that you were actually in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow during the time of the annexation of Crimea and the incursions into the Donbass, and actually were down at the border monitoring Russian troops coming in to Ukraine, which they were denying. It's a fascinating story. You want to just share that briefly for us?
Yeah. This is part of the color of the book. I mean, it's not just a dry – this was my doctoral dissertation. It's not just a dry kind of – diplomatic history. It's also my own firsthand experiences. I was a Russian speaker, Ukrainian linguist, trained by the Defense Language Institute in Ukrainian. I had the best capability to and infantryman understanding how battlefield support works. I think in a lot of ways I was pretty well suited to be able to undertake multiple missions to the border almost on a weekly basis to monitor what the Russians were claiming were, you know, basically nothing to see here, benign, to what they were really doing, which was basically engaging in hybrid and then outright military aggression and catching them red-handed. So
And you caught them red-handed. Just be clear about what the smoking gun, which is your term for what you found, was. What was the smoking gun?
Taking military materiel and personnel and throwing them across the border to support what they claimed was an internal civil Ukrainian affair, but in fact was a Russian-supported separatists and Russian military direct involvement in this war that started in 2014.
You are also quite critical of President Biden in his, although he has backed Ukraine, your argument is not nearly enough. And there's a pretty striking passage I want to read from your book on this. So even as President Biden pledged to give Ukraine all the support it needed to win the war, his administration blocked the transfer of Soviet-era jets to Ukraine, declined to provide Ukraine with sufficient long-range air defenses to clear the skies of Russian planes, withheld the quantities of long-range rocket systems and munitions needed to destroy Russian targets, and halted discussion of the transfer of manned and unmanned aircraft required to neutralize Russian long-range attacks on Ukraine's cities. That's a pretty harsh critique. Were you saying this at the time, and how do you explain the Biden administration's failure to do what you argue was absolutely essential to defend Ukraine?
Yeah, so maybe not harsh enough, frankly. First of all, you know, we talked about a couple of administrations. Really, it starts with George H.W. Bush through Clinton, who I frankly, like, I'm maybe most forgiving of, to George Bush that stared into the eyes of Putin and saw his soul all the way through. Biden specifically, I was engaging with the administration, providing them my advice in these consultation sessions that we had really since before the war started, and where I was on the record saying, it's coming, let's do more to avoid it, and writing a piece in the New York Times talking about sanctions, talking about putting folks on the border, arming Ukraine to at least try to warn off this massive war that has so many different risks the moment shots get fired. So I think from that standpoint, I told them that I explicitly told them, and then eventually I told them, I told you so, that you're going to do all these things that you think are going to be impossible. You're just going to do them late, and you're going to do them in a way that's not going to be effective at either helping Ukraine or preventing the war or achieving a ceasefire.
To whom did you say this? To whom did you say this, by the way?
To the administration.
Who in the administration?
To the administration.
Did you meet with Jake Sullivan on it? Or
we're talking about NSC folks.
Okay.
Seniors. So the point is that, you know, this is not something, and this is also something I wrote about publicly. It wasn't just, you know, kind of talking to the reason that this is important is that it wasn't just me saying this publicly that we need to do more. I was also in frank, detailed conversations making the same case to the administration, but clearly not persuasively enough. This is maybe part of I might need a new line of work, because I've been, you know, calling these things out and speaking about these dangers for years,
yeah,
including being authoritative, writing the strategy for the Department of Defense, and, you know, still not having enough influence to avert what I saw were, you know, coming disasters and train wrecks. So I don't know. I'm gonna do a kid's book next or something like that. And,
all right. Well, before you do that, let's. Putting aside mistakes of the past, we are where we are right now. The Ukrainian counteroffensive in 2023 failed to regain much territory. The Russians seem to be driving out of the Ukrainians out of their territory in Russia, and seem to be making steady gains in Ukraine itself. They control the Donbass, they control Crimea. It is hard to see at this point in time a strategic path by which the Ukrainians can dislodge the Russians from Donbass and Crimea. If that's the case, doesn't that argue for some kind of deal that is essentially the status quo? The Russians get what they got. The Ukrainians keep what they have, their security guarantees, and we call it a day.
Yeah, I'm frankly not even sure where to begin with that. I mean, that sounds so far off to me.
Do you see a strategic path for the Ukrainians to dislodge the Russians from Donbass?
Yeah. So to be very clear, the narrative is that Russia is on the march. Success is inevitable. That is far from the reality. The question is, do the Russians have the staying power at the pace of progress to achieve their objectives? Or are they going to hang on in a lot of ways on a hope and a prayer that they win in engaging with Trump, something that they couldn't deliver on the battlefield? They're taking massive losses. And the picture is a more difficult for the Ukrainians in Kursk, in this part of Russia that they're occupying. It's actually not as bad on Ukrainian territory in Donetsk. Specifically, they are actually conducting successful counterattacks. They have been for weeks. And it's unclear if the Russians have, I mean, it's the problem to a certain extent is that neither side is sufficiently strong to achieve their objectives. The question is, who has the staying power to a certain extent? And what the Ukrainians are probably willing to do is they're probably willing to trade and compromise some territory, to, at least temporarily, not in perpetuity, but they want some guarantees. And they're not willing to forsake their population or allow the Russians to buy time. That is a fool's errand. That is basically where we started in 2014, the Russians making some gains and then developing their capability to then attack in 2022. That doesn't work for Ukraine. That doesn't work for Europe. It really doesn't actually work for the U.S. because it keeps the region in turmoil. It also has repercussions around the world with regards to whether the Chinese think that military aggression is actually in their interest. They have a one China policy. So there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to throw your hands in the air. Ukrainians aren't willing to do it because they understand the dangers. I don't think we need to be completely deferential to them. We need to advance our own U.S. national security interests, which ultimately mean that we need to figure out a way to achieve a long-term peace. But we do defer to them to a certain extent because they understand the Russians better than anybody else, and they understand the costs and the consequences of their decisions.
But I just want to be clear then, are you saying the Vindman vision for what should take place now is forget about talking to the Russians, pour all these weapons into Ukraine, advance tactical missiles, let them fire away at Russia, and somehow in some period of time they are going to dislodge the Russians from Ukrainian territory? Is that essentially the Vindman position? Yeah.
The answer is I am looking for what is going to be successful. And to me, the path of success is not to reduce and ease pressure on Russia, where they already feel like they have the upper hand and they just need to go push a little bit further. It is to put additional pressure on Russia. That's economic, that's military, that's to bolster Ukraine, that's to support the Europeans, and they're also made the calculation of what this means for their long-term security if Russia wins. And that the way the U.S. maintains its leverage is actually by engaging with Ukraine, not by cutting Ukraine off or the Europeans off and catering to Russia. That's the exact opposite of how you get to a peace, either a ceasefire or a lasting peace. So this is my counsel is to take heed the lessons of the past. They're pretty clear. We've tried things many, many times over and over. We've tried reset and it's blown up in our face. Let's learn lessons of the past. Let's stop deceiving ourselves about Russia. Let's not continue to betray Ukraine because it betrays our own interests. And let's cease this folly that we've been engaged in.
All right. Well, on that note, I want to thank you. The book is The Folly of Realism, How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. Alexander Vindman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media. Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-Roe anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.